November 3rd, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Can you believe it's December already? Thanks for joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup for this program along with relevant links, visit Spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to Spingola1@yahoo.com. My regular email is Deanna@Spingola.com, which I do not access during the program. You may join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, Spingola.com, or by going to Spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Thomas Goodrich. He is the author of numerous books, including Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944 through 1947. His website is wildwestblogcom.blogspot.com. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Deanna, how are you?
I'm very well, and you?
Very good. Let me just go back a little bit. You said, can we believe it's December already, nearing Christmas? Yes, I can, because I played Santa Claus Saturday in some sort of silly thing, a blessing of the dogs, I guess that's what it was. But it was a photo op with me in a Santa suit taking photographs of everything from Pomeranians and Peaks to pit bulls. So, yeah, I can believe it's Christmas. And something else, Deanna, let me say, I tried reaching you three different times on this 800 number, and it was only by luck, the last one, I guess, that I actually got through. That's the 9443 number, so I hope none of your listeners and callers are having the same problem as I am.
Well, that's interesting. Maybe they were on other calls or something. I'm not sure, well, you know, what to say about that. But
I got a recording several times saying, you know, hey, sorry, Charlie, you're on the wrong phone. But anyway, I hope they're not having that same problem. But yes, it's great being with you again, Deanna.
Well, thank you so much. Now, tell me how people may order Hellstorm, because you do have a few copies left at $20, and it's a book that people absolutely must read if they're the least bit interested in history, particularly of World War or post-World War II history in Germany. So how do people get that book?
I do have about 10 paperback copies left, and that may be it as far as the paperback, because I'm not sure I'm going to be getting any more from the publisher. There just weren't too many to begin with. But they can get a cheap copy of that from me for $20. That's including postage, simply by, you've got the good stuff, but they can email me at M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, Goodrich, @AOL.com, and I can fill them in on the rest. Or they can order to the publisher hardback, which are really nice books, of course, and that's from Aberdeen Press, at 303-795-1890. Or they can go to Amazon or any other sources like that. The book will be a little more expensive, but my paperback is only 20, and I'll sell those as long as I have any left. You've got the rest of the information if anybody doesn't get what I just ran through real quickly, and so maybe they can follow up with you and find the source.
Sure. Yeah, just email me, and I will direct you to the right email and or the right address or whatever you need. So just it's a fabulous book.
Yeah, let me add this also. You are a real surprise to me.
All righty, we'll save that surprise until the other side of the break. Now we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Thomas Goodrich. One of the fellas in the chat room, Uncle Rick, said maybe we should start calling him Santa Goodrich.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that's real good. I'll tell you what, that's the last time I played Santa anywhere. This was a nightmare as far as I was concerned. It was, you know, if you can imagine dogs peeing on the floor, pit bulls growling at you. You've got people that think their dog is, you know, a child, only lacking the clothing. And it was just a bizarre thing I somehow got myself into. But I doubt if I do that again next year. But, Deanna, I just wanted to add that from your other show that I did, you have a tremendous following. I was immediately bombarded by hundreds of people who listen to your program, who are avid followers of your program. I mean, it's just, I've done a lot of radio TV stuff over the last 20 years, done some major market stuff with WBAL in Washington and Baltimore and KSFO in San Francisco, stations like that. But I think the response from your program was as large as any I've ever experienced.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that.
You have really got a following.
Well, thank you. People like the truth, and that's what we try to present here on this program with guests such as yourself. And that just goes to show that people are really looking for the truth, and they want it, they're going to search for it, and they know it when they hear it.
And I think some of it has to do also, Deanna, with your personality. You've got a very wonderful, caring, giving, generous personality, and it comes across on the radio. And so I think some of that, dear lady, also has to do with you. So
now I'm blushing, so we probably ought to move on.
Okay.
Well, you have written several books, and books that I really I love history. I love the history of the so-called Civil War. And, you know, I have addressed some of the issues in one of my books about the War of Northern Aggression, because I hate to even call it the Civil War. In fact, mm-hmm. I always preface it with so-called. And you have also written a lot about this. In one of the books that you wrote, The Day Dixie Died, Southern Occupation, 1865 to 1866. Now, that's a relatively short period of time. And you wrote that book in 2001. And some of the dreadful things that happened during, and you nailed it. It was an occupation. And it was certainly the North that invaded the South. It was not something that was civil at all. The North invaded the South, slaughtered people, slaughtered animals, burned down buildings, all the buildings that they could, destroyed towns. It was a scorched earth policy that they employed. And they disrupted food production. They wanted to starve the people in the South.
I can't argue with anything you've said. In fact, let me also preface with what I'm going to say with this right now. I don't claim to be an expert on the so-called Reconstruction period of the South, 1865 to roughly 1875. I am, however, an expert on this book, The Day Dixie Died, The Occupied South from 1865 to 1866. And what you've said so far, yes, it was quite a revelation, I've got to say, Deanna, when I wrote this book. The parallels to Hellstorm are just incredible. Anyone who heard the program we did, a week or so ago on World War II, the final months and years of the war, and the post-war years, would find an immediate parallel to the so-called American Civil War. Yes, a war of Yankee aggression, Northern aggression, whatever. It's just incredible. Here we have a small group of people who go to war for their freedom, for their independence. That is the Southerners. Basically, they got tired of this this union, this confederation with the Yankees in the North. Let's not forget, I am a Yankee. I was born and raised a Yankee. When I dreamed childhood thoughts, I was always wearing blue. As a child, a soldier, I was always a Yankee. And so some of this stuff came kind of hard for me to basically turn 180 degrees around. But anyway, a small group of people, the Southerners, fighting for their freedom against this enormous machine, which was the North at that time, an industrial giant with manpower, 10 times the number of the South. And after... Again, in keeping that parallel with World War II, Germany against the world, basically, we have this ruthless, pitiless war lasting 4 years. And finally, the small number of independent-minded patriots are overwhelmed by numbers, force of numbers, by industrial might. And then, of course, came the peace, which is mostly the subject of the day Dixie died, the so-called peace. Actually, it's just war by other means, just like World War II. The victors might call it peace, but let me assure you, the vanquished, they had another word for it, and it was war, war by other means. And yes, the starvation, the murder, the torture, the rape. A lot of folks think torture began with Abu Ghraib in Iraq, or maybe perhaps World War II, if they listen to our program the other day about World War II. Well, let me assure you, the northern forces, the United States of America at that time fighting against the Confederacy, they also used torture as a means of prying loose information from people. In fact, the groans in the State House and the War Department at night down in the basement could be heard outside on the streets. And then, of course, with the so-called peace came the vilification of the Southern leaders, just like the Nazi leaders, and the demonization of the cause, the Nazi cause or the Southern cause. This total demonization until today, you see what we've got. When we talk about Jefferson Davis in the South, it's almost as if Southerners are ashamed to talk about it. That's your average Southerner. You take your sons of Confederate veterans and the daughters of the Confederacy, they're not ashamed at all. In fact, they're proud to wave the flag, the battle flag of the South. Generally, it's become verboten to talk about, much less extol, the virtues of the Southern Confederacy. When fair-minded people try to stand up for the truth, of course, they shout it down, just like with the Nazis and Germany. My premise, in the day Dixie died, is that had Lincoln survived to live out his second term, he was elected, let's not forget, had he lived that the post-war years would have been less vicious, less violent. Because let's face it, Lincoln, in one of his last speeches, in his second inaugural speech, he said it was a very compromising speech, basically with charity for all, with, you know the speech, and I'm not going to go through it all.
Sure.
But had he lived, I think he was beholden to live by those words, not suddenly turn some legal trickery here and then put the screws down the South. So I actually believe his words. Maybe I'm gullible. But, of course, Lincoln did not survive to live out his second term, and we got the renegade Southerner Andrew Johnson, who became president. And where do you want me to go from here? I could go a blow-by-blow of the story. Let's put it this way. It's one of the few books that deal honestly with what really happened in the South following the war. And it was not the moonlight and magnolias approach that we've been fed over the years, this rather benign Appomattox greeting between Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant, where they talk like old friends, that they really were, very respected, either both of them. To each other. And Lee hands over his sword, and they all go home and become farmers again, and we're back to being one nation. It wasn't that at all. It was much like, again, the what happened to Germany after the war. It was this, deliberate humiliation, starvation, rape, turning the blacks loose, the freed slaves on the South, and basically saying, go at them. It's all yours now. Go for it. A lot of folks let me go with this approach. You asked me the question, since you seem to know a lot about it, and probably a heck of a lot more than me. I'll try answering your questions. Deanna, first of all, did you read the book?
I have not read the book yet.
Okay, well, you know enough that you can still ask me some questions if you would, and I'll try to amplify on them, because it's a large topic, obviously. We still live to this very day. The repercussions from that war to this very day, yes.
Exactly. It was a war to alter the structure of the government of this country. Would you agree with that?
I would agree totally with that, yes.
And I have, in my book, my first book, I referred to the South as a colony of the North. because they had to, the people in the South, whether they were plantation owners, and many of the plantation owners arrived in the South as a result of land being seized from the Indians, and when they shoved those people westward, and some of the plantation owners came down from the North and started growing cash crops, not crops to feed the people, but cash crops to make money for the people up north. And it was the people up north that did all of the shipping to Britain. And as I say, they viewed the South as a colony. And I think the average Southerner did not own slaves. They eked out a living on the soil. We do have to take a real quick break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Today is Thomas Goodrich, the author of The Day Dixie Died, Southern Occupation, 1865 to 1866. It is available at Amazon either as a Kindle format, Kindle edition, or as a hardcover book, and I would recommend that you get it. While I have not completed reading it, I can say with a surety that it is a good book. So I made some statements about the South, and they had some cultural differences that were quite apparent. The North was secularized, while the South was more laid back, considered more Bible-based, and Christian. It was just a totally different way of life.
Yeah, I think that's safe. You know, anybody who really wants a quick trip through the South can do no worse than going to Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. It's yes, they take some license in there, of course, but I think the tone, the general tenor of the movie is right on. I know its imperfections and some of the failings, and yet I cannot think of anything better at this moment right now. And of course, the book itself is a very good book. I've read it a couple of times. Deanna, the book, as far as I know, Day Dixie Died, is no longer in print. It's either in the Kindle edition for about $15, or I've got five hardbacks that I'm willing to sell for $30. But I think after that, that's it. So we're talking about a book that's you might say gone with the wind right now, unless you've got the e-reader for Kindle.
Right, and you actually don't have to have the e-reader. You can download a program and use it on your computer to read the book. And the Kindle for PC is free.
Wow, that's neat. Yeah, I'm very proud of the book too, because, like I said, I think it's the only book that addresses what was history's first modern war and history's first modern defeat, and all the ramifications, all that suggests. History's first modern war with, fancy artillery, armored ships, actually had aerial observation with the balloons. That's what I mean by modern war with machine guns, actually, with some of the
right.
earliest machine guns. But also when I talk about history's first modern defeat, I mean that also. I mean an encompassing defeat, a total defeat.
Right.
A subjugation of a people, entire people, cities laid waste. That's what I mean by modern defeat, an ugly, ugly picture.
And wasn't it the first war that they used total war? In other words, they went after the civilian population?
I think that's safe to say, yeah. The cavalry raids, they were designed to harm the Southerners. Look at Sherman's march through through the Carolinas and Georgia, and that was nothing but an attempt to dehouse the civil population and make them tired of war. Of course, out in Missouri and Kansas, they had the same thing going on out there. General Orders Number 11, very few people even know what that is all about, and yet it's more draconian than even Sherman's march to the sea. It was basically a depopulation. Wholesale murder of people just trying to get rid of them to stop the guerrilla warfare that was occurring in that area of Missouri. So the South, or the so-called Civil War, Yeah, it's been passed down to us. We've got hundreds of thousands of reenactors every year getting out in their either the Southern or Northern uniforms and playing like they're at war. But this was not a fun thing that our people passed through. Trust me, it was something. It was, again, it's very similar to World War II. The South never did rise again. They were put down so hard that there just wasn't any rise. There's never been any really significant attempt to repeat the example.
Right. And it certainly,
by the way, yes, go ahead.
Well, it certainly centralized all power in Washington.
Yeah, for the worse. Wouldn't you agree that...
Oh, absolutely. It centralized power.
We could be no worse off today had the South seceded. I wish the South had seceded. We could be no worse off than we are today in this muddle that we find ourselves in, this wretched downward spiral of the United States. Yes, in fact, I can say this. I can be a very radical person today. I don't know why. Maybe that Santa Claus thing this weekend has got me fired up. But I don't see any problem with the United States busting down into its components. We're too big right now. It's obvious that this is not working. This entire experiment, this attempt to hold us together with the Civil War that held us, that kept the South with us in spite of their wishes, it just hasn't worked. We need freedom in this country, and we're not getting it right now. I know I'm going off on another rabbit trail here, but, whatever. Maybe
it's relevant. I think it's relevant. And and what it did, it made all of us debt slaves, and it introduced corporatocracy, which we are still suffering under, and it did get rid of slavery. But when you look at the exchange, what people... we all became debt slaves. Slavery, I don't believe in slavery, of course, but at least the people were taken care of for their entire life. They didn't have to worry about getting kicked out on the street, homeless. All righty, we do have a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Thomas Goodrich, the author of numerous books, and the one that we're discussing today is The Day Dixie Died, Southern Occupation, 1865 to 1866. You can get that book as a Kindle edition at Amazon, and I believe there are also some used books, and I would highly recommend that you purchase it. I like Kindle edition. I can put it on my iPad, and I can just, you know, it works really well for me. You were talking about Reconstruction, and you were comparing the situation in the South with the situation post-war Germany. Was there, during Reconstruction, an educational program that is comparable to the denazification program that they imposed in Germany after the war?
Oh, yeah. Yes, there certainly was. I don't know if there was an official title to all this. It could have been just a bunch of Northern do-gooders, and these are people really that are ideologues who totally believe, I'm convinced, in what they were doing. They rushed south on the heels of the carpetbaggers, of course, who swarmed over the prostate south for economical reasons. But behind them were these well-intentioned do-gooders who did want to elevate the slave. They, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin thing had a real strong impact, especially in New England. And so a lot of folks with time on their hands decided to come south and do what they could. And some were just way off the wall nuts, let's put it this way. They had this crazy notions of, they saw the world through their own eyes, and they didn't have enough sense or experience to feel around before they jumped and leapt into it. Listen to this. This is what some of the Southerners had to put up with, though. This was some of these nut jobs who did come south. I'm going to read this to you guys right now. These are Northern missionaries who come down and start schools. And this is what one person overheard in a classroom. Now, children, began the daily chant of a Yankee teacher in Louisville to a class of black students. You don't think white people are any better than you because they have straight hair and white faces. No, sir. No, they are no better, but they are different, the instructor continued. They possess great power. They control this vast country. Now, what makes them different from you? And the reply, of course, is money. Yes, but how do they get the money? Got it off us, stole it off we all. Now, this kind of indoctrination is very similar to the denazification in Germany, very similar. And this is going on all across the South, this re-education, this deliberate attempt, in my opinion, to sow the seeds of discord and hatred among two races that had lived, yes, in a master-slave relationship, but still had lived in a relative peace. Now this, rather than trying to encourage more of that same peace in a different political format, of course, the master-slave has ended, instead chooses to create the animosity, as that little passage I read to you would indicate. I've got to read to you something else, Diana. It's in a similar vein, but it shows why a lot of blacks in the South chose to remain friends with their former masters and the families they had lived with, because after all, these blacks were Southerners just like the whites were Southerners. They had a hell of a lot more in common with their fellow Southerners, than they did with these peculiar Yankees who came South with these crazed notions in their head. Listen to this. Now, white folks, announced the Louisiana black, I was going to tell you the difference between a Southern man and a Yankee. Well, the Southern man, he stop at the hotel, he asks for a room, he get the key, he say, here, Jim, take my valise. When he get the room, he said, Jim, you black rascal, brush my coat and boots and be in a hurry. While I was doing that, he wash himself, comb his hair, and take a drink, and when I gives him the boots, he hands me a dollar. When the Yankee stops at the hotel, he say, Mr. Johnson, please brush my boots. Mr. Johnson, please carry this note to Mr. Smith at the railroad depot. Mr. Johnson, please carry this message to the telegraph office. Mr. Johnson, guess I'll have to trouble you to bring me a pitcher of water. Mr. Johnson, I guess I ought to have a cigar. Run down and get me a 5-cent one. I come back and expect he's going to give me about $2, but instead of giving me the money, he asked me to take a seat and tell me about my grandfather, my grandmother, my brother, my sister, my cousin, my old master, and how much I was making and how I is and all such nonsense. And after a while, he says, well, Mr. Johnson, I guess I just have to give you a dime before I leave. Now, white folks, that's the difference between the Southern man and the Yankee, and it's every word the truth, too.
Wow, that is very interesting.
Yeah, these stingy characters come South with their head filled with notions, and they neglect the little things, like the tip there, the stinginess of it all. But
right.
Anyway, the book, as obviously, that was a direct quote from the book I was reading. The book is not all horrors and terrible stories. There's lots of interesting stuff like that throughout. I do have 5 of those hardback copies left, and like I said earlier, that's it. Once these are gone, there are no more hardback. It's all Kindle from then on.
Right.
Or, like you say, used books.
Now, did Rockefeller fund this educational process in the South?
Rockefeller, I don't know. Now, that's where you probably could instruct me on a few things. I don't know, Deanna. Certainly, funding came from somewhere.
I believe they did. And Harriet Beecher Stowe, who you also mentioned, was simply a rabble-rousing propagandist. She'd never been to the South before she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and wrote all of this just to create chaos,
mm-hmm.
and to create anger among the Northerners, who would not have fought to free the slaves, because, well, for one, they also owned slaves up north. The rich people owned slaves. And it actually started up north. And most of the people who traded slaves lived in the north.
Yeah, there's the hypocrisy of the north. It was incredible during this period. While some northerners, once they ran into blacks, despised them, loathed them, treated them worse than dogs, animals, they still persecuted the southerners for having them as slaves. In which the Southerners, in spite of all the crazy stuff that's been going around recently from the 1960s to now about how terrible life was on the plantation, most of that is a bunch of hogwash. I have done a lot of studies myself on a typical plantation. Now, true, the further south you went, the larger the plantation, the harsher, I think, were the conditions. It doesn't make sense, however, that a master, a slave master, would abuse, mistreat, and certainly not kill something that he has paid $2,000 for. That is not the way it operates, I'm sorry. Up in the border states, Missouri, Kentucky, places like that, some of the blacks lived with some of the white families right in their cabins. I mean, we were talking really small operations here, but they were, in essence, part of the family. Yes, they were a slave, but as far as treatment, it wasn't appreciably different from the white folks themselves. Now, would I have liked to have been a slave at the time? I don't know. I would prefer to be a slave than off on my own living under a bridge somewhere, starving. I don't know. I don't have the answer. I wasn't alive then. I'm a slave to my sources, and yet my sources tell me that the picture I'm getting is a lot different from the picture portrayed in movies and a lot of the books, a lot of the history books out there now.
Right. Such as the one, Roots, by Alex, who was that?
Haley. I didn't read that book. I didn't even see the movie, so I can't comment on it. I know it was a very popular movie, and I'm assuming since it got rave reviews, it was very inaccurate.
You're correct, right.
That's generally the way it goes. And speaking of new movies, of course, there was the Lincoln movie. I went with my wife Friday night to see the latest vampire movie. She's a nut for that. Twilight, the Twilight thing, whatever. Uh-huh. Are you familiar with that? It's about vampires.
No, I'm not into the vampire thing.
Neither am I, but I had to go. But the Lincoln movie, they asked us if it was for the Lincoln movie we were there for, and said nope. And it was good because it was sold out. Apparently the movie is just going gangbusters right now. But
it's a propaganda by Spielberg.
Probably, yes. Since it's from Steven Spielberg, it's probably nothing but a lot of feel-good nonsense. And by the way, I've never been a Spielberg fan. It's just too shallow and superficial for my movies. I like them with more depth. And so I probably will never see this movie simply for that reason. And also for the propaganda value. No, I'm not into that either. I do know something about Lincoln, and whenever you feel like hearing about it, we can talk about Lincoln a little bit. What I know, in fact, you probably, again, know more about Lincoln than I do, Deanna.
He's certainly been glorified. He's been glorified. He's got the Lincoln Memorial. I think had he lived, he would have had to answer an awful lot of questions.
Yeah, that's safe to say. And had the fortunes of the South been different, he might have well spent time in prison, just like Jefferson Davis did, in a ball and chain, for some of the things that happened while he was president. Yeah, the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, arbitrary arrests right and left, prisons groaning with political prisoners. That are in there without trial, without being accused, and without trial. Torture, as I mentioned. We never really recovered from the so-called Civil War. That's where the old America ended and the new began, for better or worse. And of course, we both believe it was for the worse.
Would you say that his assassination made him a martyr and a hero?
Absolutely, yes. I don't, like yourself, I think had he been allowed to live out his second term, I think the warts would have started coming through, because we'd have been going through that period where I do believe he did want to let the South down easily. That's his terms. And I do believe he wanted a more amicable peace, but he did not. And, of course, the radicals in the North seized upon his assassination as the pretext to foist upon the South their draconian version of peace, war by other means. And so, yes, it was terrible. Lincoln, prior to the moment that bullet entered his head, he had been the most loathed and unliked American president in history. Now, he had just won the war, it's true. Lee had surrendered. The South was surrendering everywhere, the armies. And so he was a victorious president when he entered Ford's Theater that night, his last night on Earth. He would have been the toast of the free world at the time. He would have been the toast of the Western world. But that bullet, of course, immediately raised him to sainthood status. He became a martyr. He became almost godlike. I talk about that not just on the day Dixie died. I did another book on Lincoln's assassination and its impact on the North. And immediately right after Lincoln's death, no longer could you criticize Lincoln. You could, and you might end up dead if you did. I'm very serious about that. That's what the other book called The Darkest Dawn deals with. This race to make a very common man, to turn a very common man into a saint, this godlike figure. And it was because, yes, Lincoln had been criticized harshly in the first 4 years of war. And suddenly he had turned this thing around. In other words, people who thought that Lincoln couldn't do it, that they could never force the South to surrender, could never subjugate the Confederacy, well, they were wrong. Lincoln did it. And suddenly Lincoln is killed, and they have no chance to thank him. They have criticized him for 4 years, called him a hairy ape, a goon, a monster, a tyrant. And so many people in America suddenly felt shame that they had been that critical. The man had succeeded. He was right. But now they could not thank him. And so their approach was, like any other humans, we'd do the same thing today, is to raise him to this godlike stature and forget his failings. Forget the bad things about Lincoln. And believe me, there were a ton of them. Forget all that. And don't you dare bring it up, because if you do, that proves you're against Lincoln, anti-Lincoln, pro-South, and we'll throw you in jail or kill you, perhaps. A lot of folks don't know that right after Lincoln was killed, a tremendous purge swept America for the next 2 weeks, mostly within the next 48 hours after Lincoln was killed, but it did continue for weeks afterwards, a purge. In the North, let's remember, a significant percentage was anti-Republican, anti-Lincoln, and they called them copperheads. That doesn't necessarily mean they were pro-South. It means they were pro-Constitution, anti-tyranny, and they never missed a beat when it came to criticizing Lincoln and Republicanism, in spite of the fear of being thrown into prison, or worse, having your business closed down, having your newspaper wrecked. But still, a lot of these folks did comment, make those comments. And so now Lincoln's dead, and their neighbors turn against them. They remember those comments that they made, those anti-Lincoln comments. They remembered that they were Democrats. They voted Democrat. And they turned against them, and there wasn't anybody to stop them. America was just turned loose to the mobs in the first 48 hours and all the way up for about 2 weeks. The people, the Republicans, basically, it was something very similar to the French Revolution, the terror of the Jacobins. And my estimate is that hundreds died. Millions of dollars in property, of course, were destroyed in fires and the riots that occurred afterwards. And it's one of the best-kept secrets in American history. Unlike Hellstorm, which is the best-kept, bloodiest secret in world history, that's World War II. What happened to the Germans. This is the best-kept secret in American history. And it still has very little, except people who have read my books, especially The Darkest Dawn, very few people know of this.
Amazing.
When I say they turned upon their neighbors, I mean literally turned upon their neighbors, murdered them, burned their homes down. There's a lady in Des Moines, Iowa, of all places, who had been a critic of Lincoln. She was in her home when Lincoln was assassinated and the news reached Iowa. She was on her sickbed. Well, she was dragged out by the ladies of the community, the church ladies, and forced to walk around town waving a U.S. flag. And when her 13-year-old daughter tried to protect her mother, who was sick, don't forget, She was beaten up by the mob.
Oh, my goodness. All righty, we do have to go to a break. You can get The Darkest Dawn, Lincoln Booth, and The Great American Tragedy at Amazon. We'll be right back. Deanna, and our guest today is Thomas Goodrich, the author of numerous books, including two of them that Thomas is talking about today, The Day Dixie Died, Southern Occupation, 1865 to 1866, and The Darkest Dawn, Lincoln Booth, and The Great American Tragedy, which is not available as a Kindle, but it is available as a hardcover and as a paperback at Amazon. One of the beauties of your books, because of the sources that you use, makes the reader feel that he or she is immediately transported to the relevant time and place. And this is such a wonderful characteristic, and it really ties people to the feelings that you are. I anticipate that the feelings that you are feeling when you wrote these things, when you opened those diaries, I think that you felt the pain and the poignancy of the things that you were reading, and you have this great ability of putting it into your writing so that people can feel what you felt.
You know, Deanna, as many books as I've written, as often as I've been on radio, and as many reviews as my books have received, I've never heard it said that way. Thank you very much. That is really beautiful. I hope to listen to this recording and maybe paraphrase exactly what you said. I try to do that, Deanna. I honestly do. I try to be as neutral, unbiased, and fair as I possibly can to both sides. Of course, I've got my opinions. I've got my bias. But in my opinion, there's no place, the history book is no place to parade my agenda. And so I try to be as fair as I possibly can, but I also try to understand who I'm writing about as to the best of my ability. Even if it's someone I dislike, I try to understand what they're thinking. And when I come to their journals, their diaries, newspaper accounts, I do very much try to get as much of their thoughts and words into the story as possible. Some people, unfortunately, cannot express themselves very well, so that's where I come in, and I have to write these in my own words. But yes, I think there is a sense of immediacy in virtually all the books I have written. A sense of being there, a you are there approach, because I do let the people talk as much as I can. I let the reader know what's going on in their mind, whether it's a woman going through her 15th rape that night in Germany as the Russians roll through, or whether it's a white Southerner in Tennessee who's forced up on a cupola in the county courthouse, atop the county courthouse by Yankees, who have forced him up there just for entertainment, so he can provide entertainment to the entire town. This is after the war, of course. The humiliation involved in that, of cutting off the buttons of Southerners, and what that felt like to a Southern man who had fought for 4 years to the best of his ability, how that felt to him, to have his buttons cut off by Yankees. Or, again, what it was like in the Indian Wars, Scalp Dance. People have called that one of the best books on the Indian Wars because I let the folks do the talking themselves.
Which allows the reader to make their own conclusions,
right.
Unbiased. It's wonderful. All right, we do have our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back. Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. Our guest today is Thomas Goodrich, the author of numerous books, two of which he is discussing today, The Day Dixie Died, Southern Occupation, 1865 to 1866. And the other book is The Darkest Dawn, Lincoln Booth, and The Great American Tragedy, both of which are available at Amazon. And his website is... and the name of the website is very, very interesting. The website is wildwestblogcom.blogspot.com. And, of course, that will be posted in the description of today's program. Again, that is wildwest, blogcom.blogspot.com. And Thomas, you were talking about the way that you write your books, and that you have the ability, you certainly do, of putting people right there. And then people can draw their own conclusions. They are not being told what to think. They are being given the facts and the situation, and then they can arrive at their own conclusions, which is so different than the way that other writers present their information. They tell you what to think, and they provide they have an agenda, and you don't. Your agenda is obviously to tell the truth and to make these facts known to your reader.
Well, thank you so much. I really do appreciate that. That's what I strive for. I don't think it's the role of a historian to be a propagandist. I think it's our role to set the table and do it as well as we can and let the people come and decide what they want for supper. For instance, there's one book that I've received very little negative criticism about the objectivity of any of my books. When I do receive that, I'm really not concerned at all, because I know where my heart's at. But some of the criticism is basically that I'm in their playground messing with their ball, I guess. In other words, they criticize because I'm not going with the flow. I am not adhering to the strain of propaganda, and that's the only conclusion I can come to, is that I'm not towing the line, so to speak. The day Dixie died, some of the criticism there were that I seem to be advocating slavery, or I favor slavery, or I'm anti-black. I defy anybody with an open mind to read that book and suggest that to me. That's just not the way I operate. That also goes with a book I wrote on the John Brown period. In many ways, I admired John Brown. He was an activist. He got off his butt and did something, unlike so many people today. Who doesn't admire that? He had the world against him, and yet he still went ahead and did it. Now, some of his ends that he sought are diametrically opposed to it. Turn the slaves loose with machetes and knives and guns in the South. That's a terrible thing. But I can still, yes, I can still admire John Brown for some of his other motives. But no, what you just said about the objectivity, and that's just exactly what any historian worth his salt would love to hear, is that I'm impartial, as I should be when I write a book.
Right. And you've written so many wonderful books. Bloody Dawn, The Story of the Lawrence Massacre, which was horrific. Oh, my goodness.
That was my first book. And, I was living in the town at the time, Lawrence, Kansas. And I had often thought of the Lawrence Massacre. And one year, the local telephone directory came out, and they had the date wrong for the Lawrence Massacre. Here was the singular event in that city's history, and they could not even get the date right. So I thought, this is obviously something I need to help them with. And so I went to work on that book, and it's been made into movies, actually, that book.
Great. All righty, we have a break, and we will take some calls after we return from the break, but we do want to listen to Thomas more about on more of his experiences and his writing. Deanna, my guest today is Thomas Goodrich. He is the author of some very wonderful books, including Hellstorm, The Death of Nazi Germany, 1944-1947, The Day Dixie Died, Southern Occupation, 1865-1866, The Darkest Dawn, Lincoln, Booth, and the Great American Tragedy. We do have some callers lining up. Why don't we go ahead and take a couple of callers here? And keep your calls relevant. Let's take Ed in Jersey. Ed, are you there? Okay, Ed's not there. Let's take Pat. Okay, Patrick in Georgia.
Yes. Hello, Deanna. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Enjoying the show. Just got so much I want to say. It's been a blast listening to you guys. The first thing I wanted to ask is if both you and your guest were aware of the fact that Booth was Jewish. And I got that information from Commander William Guy Carr's book, Pawn of the Game. And also, the fact that I agree with your guest that the primary reason why Lincoln was killed is because if he would have lived, he would have been the South's best friend. He would have resisted all the harsh programs the radical Republicans wished to implement. And that's why they had to get him out of the way. That's my belief from my research. And you know, having grown up in the South, I can tell you, born and raised in Georgia, you're correct. Every time I've traveled out of Georgia, it's like when people hear me and they find out where I'm from, like when I went to Oregon or I went to California, you just got a bunch of dirty looks, like I was, you know, not shouldn't be there. And it's just because of the school and the demonization that we white Southerners have had over the past four decades or five decades or more, I guess. And I know it's been heavy since I've been born, for sure.
You know, I have to agree with you. I've spoken throughout the South. I've spoken to a lot of, in fact, maybe most of the Sons of Confederate veteran groups. And I think it's because you guys are still racially solid. I mean, in spite of this indoctrination that's been going on for decades now, trying to scatter us to the winds, the South, at least the last time I was there, still had some racial solidarity and weren't afraid to talk about it. And I think that's what your average sheep-minded individual in Oregon might fear. I mean, I don't know how that's progressing now, and I'm sure probably it's been chopped away, but I've enjoyed traveling throughout the South, as I have most of America, quite honestly. I'm not afraid of Southern history. In fact, I'm not a Southerner by birth, but you might say I am by choice. As I said, had I been alive at that time, I would have either gone to Canada or two, fought for the South, but I would have never fought for the North, simply because, you know, basically, I don't think the Southern states entered into that agreement, that is, the Articles of Confederation or the Union, with the idea that, hey, I can never get out of this contract. I'm stuck with this for the rest of my life. No way in heck would anybody in their right mind join a contract that they can't get out of. And so I think the South had every right on earth to leave. I think, yes, Northern aggression, Deanna, is probably the term I would use also. Are we better off because Lincoln forced the South to stand Union? I don't think too many people in the South would agree with that. Maybe they would. I damn sure don't. Like I said earlier in the program, we could not be any worse off had the South won, had we two nations right now, or 10 nations for that matter, than we are right now with our freedoms going down the tube, with one war after another and our name being fought with Stone Age countries around the world. Our money, the trillions of dollars of debt to support these wars. Anyway, there I go again, off on that rabbit trail. But I agree with the caller that the South has really been blackballed ever since the war, and I think it still goes on to a degree.
Absolutely.
Well, I know right up until just a few years ago, they were still trying to attack the Confederate flag that was flying. They've even changed the rebel mascot at the University of Ole Miss.
Right.
And they took down all the rebel flags. Everywhere they see the rebel flag flying, boy, they just, the people that with ACLU and the ADL and Southern Poverty Law Center, they just go crazy. You read their website. I was reading their website back in 2002, the Southern Poverty Law Center's website, that is. And they were boasting proudly, openly, that was one of their proudest accomplishment, was forcing these capitals throughout the South to remove that sign of hatred and racism, which the reason it was flying, in my opinion, is not to say, hey, we're against blacks, but, hey, we stand against this federal encroachment. And it was, in my opinion, the reason I would fly it is to say I am against the tyranny of the federal government, period.
Poverty Law Center, that's a greasy, dirty little business, isn't it? They set themselves right up in the heart of the South and then humiliate and denigrate the Southerners and expect the Southerners to love them, I suppose. Yeah, I've heard quite a bit about this crew, and a motley crew it is, by the way. There's more of my radicalism sticking out, Deanna. Like I said, the Santa Claus thing just sent me over the edge. But
I'm a radical, too.
But, you know, back to John Wilkes Booth being a Jew, I had never heard that. I do know quite a bit about the Booth family, but I'd never heard that. I'll tell you what, until I actually ran it down myself, I dismissed that, because until I could actually find the proof myself.
Commander Guy Carr put it in his book, Pawns of the Game, and he does not cite a source, but he just names it as
well,
it's automatic.
Well, that's the problem with Guy Carr.
That's why I don't use him.
I was thinking
that the people who were alive at that time when he wrote that book were probably more aware than we are now. And so it's like the way I took it is he did not feel it necessary to give a source, because he was just assumed that everybody who was interested would be aware of that fact, especially him coming from a long line of Jewish actors.
You know something, I'm going to say this right now about John Wilkes Booth. This seems like a pretty good forum to mention it in, with the Lincoln movie running around right now. John Wilkes Booth, I don't know what both of you know about him, but let's put it this way. He was the Tom Hanks and of his day, and the Tom Cruise, and you go on and on. He was the top of the food chain as far as acting, come from the first family of acting at the time. John Wilkes Booth was good. He was the A-team. He was loved by America. He was the top of his game. He had fame. He had fortune. He had females. He had a future. And yet he threw it all away with that one bullet at Ford's Theater on that one roll of the dice. He loved the South so much that he was willing to give up all of that, the fame, the fortune, the females. He thought he might pull the South's chestnuts out of the fire at that last moment, the 11th hour. Of course, he was terribly wrong. We know that now in hindsight. But Booth didn't have the retrospect. He thought there might be riots in the street. If he could get rid of this terrible tyrant, this Brutus, he thought that the South might still pull it off, might still gain its independence.
I kind of disagree based on the history that I've researched. He was not a true native-born Southerner. He had nothing in common with people like myself and my ancestors who had to work their own land. I didn't grow up with any money. We didn't own any slaves. None of my family had slaves. We were poor. I come from a family of sharecroppers. And, you know, growing up like that, I have to question what common interest did Booth really have with the people of the South? And the only thing that happened was he took away the South's best friend. The war was over, and Lincoln was the only man who could have stopped the Radical Republicans program from going forward.
Okay.
And the Radical Republicans program wanted to take away the land and from the whites and give it to the blacks and put the blacks in charge. They put them in positions of power and authority over the defeated whites to humiliate us. And that's my final comment. Thanks for taking my call. I'll hang up and listen to you guys.
Thanks so much. Appreciate that.
You know, the fact is, though, that John Wilkes Booth gladly gave up his life for whatever reason. I think it was because he was a quintessential patriot. He gave it all up. Well, let's put it this way. He kills Lincoln in a theater surrounded by Lincoln's admirers in a city that's the most armed camp in the world. His chances of getting away, pulling this off, are really small. And yet he went ahead and did it, and he almost pulled it off.
There are some people that feel that he did escape.
I know. I also talk about that in The Darkest Dawn. I'm satisfied that Booth is buried in Baltimore, like they say he is, with the tattoo on his wrist. Again, I'm not the final source on this thing or the final answer. I'm a creature of my sources. I go where they take me, and I try to decide which is the most accurate, the most honest source. And I just do the best I can with that. John Wilkes Booth is an enigma. Agreed. He is one of those fascinating individuals in American history. And by the way, I hate to get started again, because I do want to say a few things about the Lincoln that I ran into.
Okay, we do have to go to a break, so we will be right back in 3 minutes, and we'll pick it up on the other side of the break. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Thomas Goodrich, and would you compare Lee Harvey Oswald in any way to Booth and the similar situations that existed after they assassinated a president in terms of the changes that it brought about?
You know, I'm not an expert on either Booth or Lee Harvey Oswald. I find no similarities between the two.
But the fact that they were both killed right away to silence them, and then the changes in the government, the structure of the government.
Yeah, that may be the future of anybody who kills an American president, is that they're put out of commission quickly. But other than that, you know, and some of the other crazy similarities that were, I think.
Right. Both of them have you know, similar names of vice presidents and that stuff, like
yes,
Johnson.
Yes, that kind of goofy stuff, which is put in there to suggest that there's some higher power, I suppose, orchestrating this thing. I tend to not believe into that kind of stuff, but I don't know. Lee Harvey Oswald, we've had four presidents killed, by the way, in office, and not just Lincoln and Kennedy, but correct me if I'm wrong, I think Chester A. Arthur and McKinley.
McKinley, and there were actually 8 attempts, because there were attempts on other people.
Garfield, excuse me.
Garfield.
I said Chester
yeah,
A. Arthur.
Garfield.
Mm-hmm. Garfield, yes, and plenty of attempts, yeah.
No, I think the
with me.
Taylor.
Excuse me?
President Taylor was also, they say that he was poisoned.
Poisoned, that's right. Hey, by the way, while we're on the subject, we seem to be skipping around a little bit with these books and things. That's just fine. Anybody who wants to send me an email, I can send them back an attachment that shows the books I've got for sale that I'd be willing to sell and the price. And all they got to do is, you know, put the money in my PayPal, and we're running along here fine. But my email address is M as in Michael, T as in Thomas, Goodrich at AOL.com. And that's all they have to do. And rather than bug you all day for that, or.
Okay, and that's your PayPal account, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All righty. We have a couple more callers. Let's try. Let's get them real quick. Sherry in Kansas. Quickly.
Oh, Deanna?
Yes.
Hi, this is Sherry from Kansas.
Right, got it.
This is very interesting, and I've got a couple questions. Now, the gentleman from Georgia, I think it's interesting that, Republicans are supposed, you know, in modern times, they're supposed to be so anti-communist, but really what he was calling the radical Republicans could also be called the red Republicans, from what I understand. And Deanna, you might know more about this than Tom, but could you comment on the 48ers? And also, was the Civil War the War of Northern Aggression not a continuation of communist revolutions that were, would you call it
Thomas,
that?
Thomas, what do you think?
It sure smells like it, doesn't it, a little bit? This basic, it does have some similarities to the communist revolutions later on. I've never thought of it like that, but that's kind of startling when you put it that way. Yeah, it's just turning over of the... all I can say right now is that warrants some further investigation, because it does sound like a pattern here that develops from the American Civil War, or perhaps the French Revolution is where it actually began. But it does have some similarities to the revolution in Russia, things like that, the slaughter of the peasants, so to speak, the starvation. and this regimen, this cruel political system they foist upon the defeated. Yep, I have to agree with the caller, Sherry from Kansas.
Right. And of course, I agree, too. I covered this in my book, that many of the people that fought in the Union were actually people, immigrants, who had come over from the socialist mm-hmm. revolutions in 1848 and 49.
Right.
And at least over 500,000 people fit that description, and they've all fought on the Union side. They felt that they were not successful in Europe, so they would come over and experience success here, and they did.
Wow.
They also put Lincoln into power. And it was very interesting.
I tell you what, just this little tidbit I can throw at you. Two of John Brown's gang, he had a gang of roughly anywhere from 10 to 24 somewhere. Two of them were Jews from fleeing Hungary, I believe, revolutionaries from Hungary, two of the characters with them. I forget their names. August Bondy was one of them, and then I forget the other one. But yeah, the revolutionaries from Hungary, from Germany and Austria, places like that, yes, that's true. I've just never thought much about that.
Right.
Well, Tom, I do not admire John Brown, and I sure don't think he deserves a mural up in the Capitol.
Right.
He's got it, though, doesn't he? Isn't
yeah.
that impressive?
All right, thanks.
Thanks,
Sherry. All righty. We are going to break, and when we come back, we'll bring up Shelley from Texas. And so we'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay tuned. All righty. Welcome back. This is Hannah, and our guest today is Thomas Goodrich, and we have another caller. Let's quickly take Shelley in Texas. Shelley, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello, Deanna, and what is your first
Thomas.
Name? Goodrich, I'm sorry.
Thomas.
Thomas, okay, Thomas, hello. I'm wondering if either of you know about the Abbeville Institute, A-B-B-E-V, as in Victor, I-L-L-E?
Yeah, I've heard of something like that.
It is like a... an establishment, or, well, I guess it's an association of scholars. I bet, Deanna, would you consider Thomas DeLorenzo a court historian in any way?
In some respects.
Okay. I thought you did. I know you had him on when you first started, and you haven't really mentioned him since that I can recall.
Well, I like his writing. I'm not a libertarian. The libertarian group is it started, I believe, Ayn Rand was really the inspiration for that that political group. But I like his writing. I think he's done some excellent work.
Well, he is one. Clyde Wilson is one of the scholars. The reason I found out about the group is. An old college professor of mine with Dr. Livingston started it, and it was to study real Southern history and culture, and also the, you know, the political misinterpretation of the Constitution, I guess, the the right for secession. That and anyway, it's more philosophical, but. I just wondered if you had heard of it.
Is it based in South Carolina?
It is.
Around Aiken?
Mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
Is it?
Let's see.
Then that's where I've heard of it. I believe they've got their own library.
Oh, yeah. I've got several of their CDs and DVDs. All of my beloved ex-professor who passed away in 2006. But he's. I talked to Dr. Livingston.
Yes, because I've done research there, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yeah. Well, good. Yeah. So you know about it.
Yes.
Yeah. It looks like it's an excellent, excellent source.
Yeah.
And
you're in Texas?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dr. Lentz taught at the University of Houston for, oh, goodness, decades. He was mm-hmm. just a much, much loved professor, and I studied... a lot of philosophy under him, but I was a major in pre-med student, so.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he He was just a really good faculty.
Well, we've all had at least one good professor that we don't forget. Somebody who
he lives in my heart forever. He's just a wonderful, wonderful human being. But he, with Dr. Livingston, apparently he started this in 1991, and no one was interested because of the misinterpretation of the Southern culture and tradition and the myth taught about the Civil War. And he, in an attempt to correct that...
Well, let me crash one myth right here. At least it was a myth with me. The Ku Klux Klan, they have been denigrated and vilified, of course, right up until now. In fact, the problem. Well, anyway, I can guarantee you this, that they were the right men in the right place at the right time when they came around originally. There was nobody else taking care of the Southern people, the white Southerners. It was the scallywags amongst them. It was the carpetbaggers from the North. It was many of the freed blacks. And it was anarchy in the South when the Ku Klux Klan originated. Now, what happened later, I'm not an expert on the Klan or Southern history, just this period. Certainly, any other people would fall behind and love anyone who did what the Klan did 1865 forward.
Yeah, I can see that now. Well, Deanna, you might know this. Was the KKK like the, the Nazi groups? Was it infiltrated? I've heard that the KKK was, actually I've heard people say that the KKK was intentionally founded to create dissension.
I'm not an expert on that. I do believe that many organizations are infiltrated in order to control them, but I can't say anything about the KKK. But anyway, thank you so much for your phone call.
All right. Well, thank you, and I'm glad you know of that great resource. Thank you, Thomas. And I'll read your books. Try to.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All righty. So talk to us some more about the situation during that 1 year occupation, the beginning of the occupation, what they did, and you mentioned rape and pillaging and all of the other things. So tell us what was happening.
Well, of course, we had the dreaded specter of the slaves newly freed. A lot of the slaves, quite honestly, they did run amok. They had the freedom, and they had this idealized notion of freedom as being a life of leisure and doing zero, and they tried to live up to that. They did as little as possible, and they were, of course, idle hands. They were in mischief a lot, robberies, rapes, crimes. Most of the blacks behaved themselves. A lot of them wanted to stay with their former masters. This was their families, and quite honestly, the South had been so impoverished by the war and so destroyed that there was just no way that the land could support the people anymore. The crops were lying fallow in the field. And so we've got a people in movement right now, the blacks. And the whites weren't much better because after the Civil War, there was just very few opportunities for whites to find employment, to make money. They were forbidden to do certain things. They certainly couldn't form organizations. They couldn't join the military. Much of the infrastructure of the South was destroyed. Also, the railroads, the steamboats, the rivers were clogged with debris. There just wasn't much going on. And then we've got this spectacle of the infestation from the North of these vampires, basically, who moved to the South to sell this and that, to take over companies. Perhaps that was the plan all along. If it wasn't the plan, it should have been, because that's the way it developed. They came down, they took, they saw, they conquered, and they took it to themselves. It was a time when, to us, looking back over 100 years, it seems rather benign. It certainly didn't seem benign to those people at the time. Most Southerners dealt with it, though. They tried, I'm talking white Southerners, tried to get along. They were tired of war. They went through 4 years of this stuff. Every family lost at least one member, it seems. And so they were ready to move on, but at every opportunity, it seems the Yankees just weren't ready themselves to move on. They had to, in every way possible, humiliate and denigrate these people over and over. There were humiliations at every step of the way. Let me say something. Before we get too far away, I'm going to forget entirely about Mr. Lincoln here, unless I get this out. The South, I don't know how much more I can say on that, except it was very bad. People grew up, as you can see, Deanna, I'm getting away from the central thought I had there with Lincoln. Let me just switch tack a little bit here with Lincoln and this upcoming movie with Steven Spielberg. I think we left folks dangling a little bit on that. Lincoln is the hardest myth I've ever had to shake in my life. I, just like you as a child, we probably both, I know I did, said the Pledge of Allegiance with Lincoln and Washington up on the wall. We have this image of him as a this humble man from the small log cabin reading books to children, that type of thing. Let's face it, the first money we held in our hand was probably a penny, and guess whose face was on that? It was Abraham Lincoln. And the movies about Lincoln, when we get to those, it seems like the movie just stops right there, and we get this church-like quality of Lincoln with the music becomes sedated, and we have this the hymns in the background. And like I mentioned just not too long ago here, I said that Lincoln was also, we forget, the most hated man in American history, at least the most hated American president, right up until the moment he was assassinated at Ford's Theater. Lincoln was hated not just because of his policies. He was hated because of who he was. He was a rustic country bumpkin. He was not a fit successor, most people felt, to such men as Jefferson and Tyler and Polk and Pierce, sophisticated men who had filled the Oval Office. Lincoln
he was a lawyer, and he was a railroad lawyer.
Yes, and that's not good in my opinion. When we have a pettifogging lawyer who loves to, I almost wish we could deny lawyers politics. I wish.
Well, that was the original 13th Amendment that got lost in history.
Because they're taught by, perhaps it's their nature, but they're also taught in college to thimble rig, to dissemble. You know what I'm going to say here, basically, to cheat and sneak and make a buck at it. And so
sure.
I don't think we should reward these people with high office. But anyway, Lincoln was a lawyer, that's for sure. But he was also this clumsy-looking fellow whose shirt, the neck was always too large for him. He looked like a freak, quite honestly. But Lincoln, more than just that, and that doesn't bother me at all, his looks, quite honestly, but things like telling filthy jokes in the White House. He was noted for telling smutty jokes. I mean, really dirty jokes that I wouldn't repeat right now on this. He was also...
He was a micromanager, wasn't he?
A micromanager. I would suppose he was. But he did some things also. Well, let's put it this way. The First Lady, without a doubt, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the worst First Lady in American history. Nobody even comes close. Nobody even comes close to Mary Todd Lincoln. And indeed, the Lincolns were the first, in my opinion, truly dysfunctional family in the White House ever. Mary, no matter how great Lincoln was after his assassination, nobody ever forgot about Mary, quite honestly. She was greedy, she was selfish, she was superficial, she was shrewish. People comment on her being a shrew. She was simple-minded. She was shallow. She was a liar. She was also a thief. There's a lot of evidence that points that Mary Lou to the White House when she left. She had two full boxcars full of China.
Kind of like the Clintons?
Well, maybe. But she was she would go through these wild rants in public. She would upbraid Lincoln in public. She would, if you displeased her, let's say you're an advisor to Lincoln, and you didn't toe the line as far as Mary was concerned, she would upbraid you right in front of everybody. Right there. Her tongue lashings
were... Opium?
Did she take opium?
Yeah.
That's a possibility. It was in vogue at the time, as you know. But Mary was just, she was just beyond anything that... in fact, they, behind her back, called her Her Satanic Majesty because of the, her behavior in public and her outbursts. Tad, their child, 9-year-old Tad, he was the brat from hell. Now, their son who died, Willie, while they were in the White House, I don't know much about Willie, but I do know a little bit about Tad. He was a child we all never really want. He was a brat. The folks were overly indulgent with him, so permissive that it makes you sick. One time, let me give you an example. Lincoln was, toward the end of the war, was in playing checkers with a friend of his, and Mary had called him to supper a couple of times, apparently. So finally she sent Tad in to bring the father in. Tad just kicked the checker table right on over. Everything went flying in the end of the game, of course. Now, in any other American family at that time, Tad would have earned 5 to 10 strokes well laid on, let me tell you. But Lincoln just smiled meekly and went on to supper. That was it. That's the kind of family we're talking about. I'm not sure how Spielberg is portraying Lincoln and his life and his wife. I've got an idea, but, wow, I'm almost positive he won't tell the truth about this. Lincoln, you know, and all that said, it's still hard for me to shake my feelings about Lincoln that, of course, I picked up when I was a kid and a young man. It's still hard, even though I know the truth about Lincoln. I still fight with this.
Right.
I still see him as a great man at times. Let me tell you this, I wouldn't wish his job upon anybody trying to fight that war, fight off the people around him at the same time. Maybe there's some areas that he should be credited with and should be admired for. But overall, no, I think our spiral downward began with the Civil War and Lincoln, the presidency, and really we haven't recovered, and we probably never will recover from this.
Right. Well, Marx and Engels absolutely loved him. And I personally believe that the so-called Civil War began with a false flag that he perpetrated, that he celebrated that. And when you look at the people that he had close to him, the socialists that he had close to him who were actually working with the generals, I mean, it's quite amazing that he deserves absolutely no accolades for what he did. And when you also consider that at least 700,000 people died to save the Union, I think he's probably one of the biggest scoundrels in history.
Well, you're on safe ground with that as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, the facts and figures don't lie. And to this very day, I ask myself, wouldn't we have been better off if South had won? And some folks will come after me and say, well, yeah, but they had slavery. Well, not for much longer would they have had slavery. They would have grown out of that, and the relationship would have been...
They were on their way getting away from slavery anyway.
That's true. That's true.
Right. All righty, we're going to our last break. We do have one last caller. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. And our guest today has been Thomas Goodrich, and somebody just emailed me a movie that you might consider, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Probably missed that one. It's got a little bit of history, a little bit of my wife's vampire, though. Maybe I should check it out. Hey, you know, before we get off, I want to put a plug in for my most recent book. It's not about World War II or Lincoln or anything like that. It's about a crime that occurred down here in South Florida, and I wrote my first true crime book, actually, and I'm very proud of it. It's, like I said, it's not the big picture stuff, but it's still about one very precious person who was taken from this world by an absolute nut job of a murderer. Her name was Denise Amber Lee. She was a cop's daughter, of all things. She was a happily married young wife who had two little babies. And one day, some totally deranged idiot walked through the door, kidnapped her, raped her, and then murdered her later on that day as she was riding around Northport, Florida with her in the back seat. And she actually got his cell phone loose and made a 911 call, and they still couldn't help her out. It's about that story. It's you might say it's America and crime in microcosm, but I'm very proud of the book. It only goes for $15. I'd be happy to sign a copy for people, and I've got 10 or so of these copies here. I'd love to send someone.
What's the name of the book?
I'm sorry?
The name of the book is?
It's called Toledo Blade.
Okay.
The true story of the abduction, rape, and murder of a cop's daughter. And Toledo Blade is the street where most of this took place.
Okay. All right.
But I'm very proud of the book, and I'd love to shoot out a couple of these to your listeners. And by the way, you must have some of the greatest listeners on earth. They got a hold of me. They're really, really loyal listeners. I can tell you that from experience.
All righty. We do have one last caller, a loyal listener, Frank in Pennsylvania. Frank, welcome to the program. Real quick, we have just 1 minute.
Okay, very good. Yes, I would like to know your guest view on General Grant's General Order Number 11 that was wrote in 1862 and what his view is on it.
Okay, Thomas.
I don't know that particular one by U.S. Grant, but I know of a General Orders Number 11 out in Missouri and Kansas area, and it was one of the most draconian acts in American history. The removal, depopulation of a technically loyal population. General Orders Number 11. Now, yours with General Grant, I'm not sure of that one. Maybe we're talking about the same thing, but it was... Yes.
Yeah, it was issued in 1862, banning certain traders, speculators, anywhere of the Jewish faith.
Oh, yes, yes, I'm familiar with that. Now,
your view on that? I'm just curious to hear it, and I'll hang up and listen to you online, okay?
Okay,
thanks, Frank.
All right. Well, in war, you know, when you're living under martial law like that and you're a general in the field with an army, I guess you can do just anything you want. I don't know a lot about it, except a man's got to do what a man's got to do. If they're infringing or impotent. Wait a minute, I'm losing my words here. If they're in the way of war, then they go. It's as simple as I can make it.
This group of people were mercenary. They were making money off the war, selling to both sides. It was,
Yeah, well, there you go.
But he had to rescind it soon.
Oh,
all righty, Thomas, we're out of time. I could go on for another 2 hours with you.
Well, you just call me up anytime. I've got lots more I could talk about if people are willing to hear it.
Oh, I'm sure they are. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Well, thank you, Deanna.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow.